Welcome to Maintainable, the podcast where we explore the art, and sometimes the mess, of software that lasts. We talk to seasoned practitioners who have wrestled with technical debt, untangled legacy code, and helped teams build sustainable, resilient systems. Because good software isn't just about shipping fast, it's about making it last. I'm your host, Robbie Russell. On this episode, I'm joined by Joe Mazzalotti, an independent consultant who helps Rails teams build mobile apps the maintainable way. We talk about what it means to be a good guest in someone else's code base, why onboarding complexity is often a signal of deeper maintenance issues, and how Joe scopes his projects to reduce both risk and deliver lasting value. Joe is also the author of Hotwire Native for Rails Developers, a guide for web developers looking to ship mobile apps without going full native. Joe joins us from Portland, Oregon in the United States. Joe Mazzalotti, we're so glad to have you join us on Maintainable. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to finally be here.
Let's get right into it. So, given your experience in the industry, what do you believe are a few common characteristics of, dare I say, well-maintained software?
I feel like I come at it from a slightly different perspective. Being a consultant, someone who works with a lot of clients, and I'm only engaged with clients for a few months at a time, I really, really value ease of onboarding. I find that it's an almost direct correlation to how easy it is for me to get someone's Rails app running to how maintained the software is and how easy it is to add changes in the future. And I'm working with some clients right now and they're kind of at opposite end of the spectrum. One is, here's a script. It does everything for you. It installs, you know, everything from Docker to, oh, my Z shell, actually, all these fun stuff, does brew. And the other one is like, your run bin set up. And you also need to have Postgres running on this port. And I so strongly prefer the latter of like, these are the dependencies you need, handle them yourself versus some like obscure script that I can't even get into. Most of the time, because the script messes up my machine in some way, shape, or form. Like, it, you know, it's not meant for a client to hop onto. It's meant for the developers in-house on their machines. But I just find that those type of over-engineered onboarding solutions end up creating so much complexity that isn't really needed, especially today with like Rails apps, how sometimes you can get them to be so lean. You know, I'm working in Rails most of the time. I'm adding iOS and Android features to it. So like, I just need the app up and running. I need to make some changes to some files. Like, I don't need to make sure that ClickHouse is running in the background or we're re-indexing your search, Elasticsearch index and stuff like that. So for me, it's like, how quickly can I get into that code base, see it running locally, and then make some changes? Though that to me is the real like North Star for well-maintained apps.
I hadn't thought to really want to dig into a lot of the aspect of being a consultant necessarily in this conversation, but since we both work in that world and there's people listening that are like, well, I work at a company and like their onboarding experience for like an employee is probably quite a bit different than what it's like for us being a temporary guest in another team's code base, right? And so we're probably working across, you know, multiple projects, different clients, different environments. So yeah, those types of like onboarding tools or scripts that will install everything for you is like, well, you're going to clobber my computer and I've got other work to do. And then there's the other people that are like, day one, what's it like? How quickly can you get that new employee up to speed? And so they can start being productive with that fresh new laptop that no one's touched. So I always find like there's kind of at odds goals there and stuff. And like most organizations with their own engineering teams aren't necessarily onboarding and offboarding people, hopefully on a super high level cadence necessarily. I mean, in terms of needing to spin up and they're not going to be around for more than a few months. How do you kind of align that in your mind?
Yeah, I agree. I'm not the target audience for the startup script for my clients right now. But I find that it's a good microcosm of like how complex they've created the space around their app. And even if it's not meant for me, it's like how much has to go into that script to get it up and running that can't be just documented, for lack of a better word, really shows how legacy this app is, how many dependencies this app has, how many things are off of the guardrails of Rails, you know, development and stuff like that. And you could be running the latest Rails version and on SQLite and like all the fancy new stuff that we're pushing right now, but still have all of these Docker dependencies for other reasons. And I think that it just really shows like how maintainable something is as a like I said, as like a microcosm, but just as like, it's a good example of what something is like to work with in the future. Even if that startup script isn't catered towards the developer that comes in for 2 to 3 months at a time.
When you're coming into these situations, what makes a good guest in another team's code base? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I really like having either a wiki or at the bottom of a README, an FAQ. There's so many things now with like, oh, if you're running Apple Silicon, like this is going to break for you. So if you have this error message, type in, you know, this bundle config, you know, obscure thing, and it will like make sure that your SSL certificates work or like something like that. I think I find those super helpful. I would rather debug myself than have a script that just like tries to do it all for me and not really know what's going on. I think that giving the developer who's onboarding a clear path of do this, this, then this, instead of like, if you're running ASDF, like do this. And if you're running RBM, do that. It's like, no, give me what you want me to use. And then I will decide if that is the tool that I want to use to follow through with this. Like, I shouldn't have to run Docker, in my opinion. I should be able to like install each one of those versions on my own or like do everything through Brew if I really wanted to. But if your recommendation is to use Docker, okay, I'll use Docker and like I'll go down that path and bang my head against the wall with it. But having like to recap, it's like I want an FAQ. I want the golden path. And if I want to veer off it, it's my fault. And I want to know how I can get the app running as quickly as possible. Those are like the three most important things to me. And, you know, way less important are like, how do I deploy? How do I track issues and stuff like that? It's like, I want to be writing code that's reflected in my local browser as quickly as possible. And whatever resistance you can drop off of that, even if that's like ENV sample files that get copied over during bin setup, that's huge. Like I don't have to talk to someone to get like a one password secrets file just to get the app up and running. Those things go a really long way. And they're not the priority a lot of times. Because like you said, they're not onboarding developers. But if you think about that and you put the time and effort into it, to me, it's like a well-maintained test suite. It's like it will continue to prove itself of the ROI on it as the app gets bigger and more complex.
I'm curious about like when you have these consulting engagements and you start looking at another team's code base, how do you think about, you know, it's like, what are you hoping that they already have for you? But also, how has your approach maybe changed where you're at right now thinking about how can you personally in this project be a good steward of that code base, a good guest visitor in that project and kind of learn that team's, how they work together? Because it might be very different than the other clients that you're working with.
One of the kind of questionnaires that I casually throw out to a new client is three questions. And it's, how do you want to collaborate on changes? How do you want to hear updates from me? And how are pull requests merged? You know, getting from most generic to most specific there. And starting really broad with like, hey, I run into an issue. Am I posting on Slack? Do I email someone? Do I open up an issue on, you know, the GitHub repo? I think that those type of guidelines are super important because it just like gives someone the opportunity to not get stuck. Like you want me to never be stuck. You want your client, consultants, your hired, you know, developers, whatever, to never be stuck or be as stuck a short amount of time as possible. And that means that I have resources available to me. Sometimes that is like a huge website that's just like a bunch of docs that I have to scroll through, you know, or search through myself. But a lot of times that is as simple as like, okay, my pull request is green. Do I merge it? Do you merge it? Does the like, you know, does one person merge it? When does it get deployed? Like the whole flow of that always kicks off a very long conversation of way more than just who clicks the green button on GitHub.
Do you try to lead those conversations really early or do you kind of incrementally do it as you get through different phases of that process?
Yeah, I have a day one kickoff kind of script that I work with new clients, but I limit it to a half hour and I get through as many of those questions as I can. And whatever I don't get through, I do incrementally. So client I'm working with right now, we spent a lot of time talking about how they have Microsoft Auth and Google Auth and how they're kind of like confused about who's who at some points. So we spent a lot of time in that first half hour call talking about that. So the first time I had a merge a pull request, I knew I had a contact there. It's like, hey, my PR is green. What happens next? And they're like, oh, you just click merge and it gets deployed. And so, you know, super simple, but the culture there, like, you don't want to mess up the culture of, oh, we actually only merge on Fridays or Mondays or whatever. So just like knowing that at the time, like before you do that, is really helpful for me.
Hey listeners, it's Robbie here. You know, it wasn't all that long ago. I'd find myself debugging a weird issue in one of our clients' Rails app. I log into one platform to track down the error, only to realize it was tied to some performance issue. And guess what? That meant hopping over into a completely different tool and trying to match things up based off of timestamps, if I was lucky. And let me tell you, my productivity didn't exactly thank me for that. Enter AppSignal, our podcast sponsor, and the tool that eliminates all that back and forth. They bring error tracking, performance monitoring, host metrics, custom metrics, uptime monitoring, and logging into one seamless platform. It's a single source of truth that helps keep your app running like a well-rehearsed symphony. Whether you're working with Ruby, Elixir, Node, Python, or tracking front-end errors in JavaScript, AppSignal has your back. They're always adding support for more languages and frameworks too. And here's the best part. AppSignal won't break the bank. Plans start at just $23 US a month. Plus, they're ISO 27001 certified and fully GDPR and HIPAA compliant. So your data is safe. Oh, and because you're a loyal Maintainable listener, you can use the promo code Maintainable at checkout for 10% off your first year. So head over to AppSignal.com. Tell them that your good friend Robbie from Maintainable sent you and start making your app sing.
Sounds like a good proactive approach there. So I commend you for that. Everybody listening there, I think there's a lot to be said. If you're joining as a consultant to a project or even as an employee, just to get some of those, make sure you understand what the workflow looks like here.
That stuff is usually never written down.
These unspoken.
It's unspoken culture of the company and it changes over time. I'm working with a client right now and they're actually a repeat client because we didn't end up finishing the project for other reasons about a year ago. They used to require running a virtual machine, a virtual Windows machine to run the app for whatever reason. And I was like, all right, cool. Like, I need a new license to this visualization software. And they were like, oh no, we don't do that anymore. Like, we just use Docker. And it's like, okay, great. That's one step better. It's still Docker. But like, those things change all the time. And there was no documentation around the change or even the original approach, because it was just the culture of what you do.
How long do you kind of wait before you start making recommendations or to them? Or how do you think about that sort of thing? But when you're building trust with this other team that might be super excited to have you, or maybe a little nervous about having an outsider come in and kind of nitpick or give some guidance on how to do things.
Yeah, I have to tread carefully for sure, because I'm hired to 99% of the time, I'm hired by these companies to build their Hotwire native apps, to build their iOS app, to build their Android app, and get them into the app stores. It's not my position to tell them that they shouldn't use Docker, for example. Like I don't have all the context. I don't have all of the background, the history. I don't know why they chose Docker. I'm not going to recommend replace Docker with any one of these technologies that they'll use that I don't think is like the right choice, so to speak. It's not my place to say, hey, you shouldn't be doing this or you should be doing that instead. But when we get down to, okay, here's how you're going to authenticate with the mobile apps, I will tell them exactly what I think should be done. And if they're doing it a different way, I will tell them the repercussions of that or the trade-offs with that. So I will have very strong opinions and I'll be very vocal about them, but only in the space that they hired me to care about. Because if I do anything else, I feel like I'm stepping out of my reins.
Has your thinking around what, I'm air quoting for those that can't see us, technical debt is or isn't over the years? How do you use that metaphor very often in your work?
I feel like technical debt in my space has become more of a topic of conversation as I go from, okay, we need an app in the app store right away. Like, let's just get it there as quickly as possible, to, okay, you're like, I'm re-engaging with a client to add new features. And it's only really in those latter conversations that we can talk about like the right way to structure Maintainable APIs and bridge components to like interact with native features that won't break, or like will break more gracefully. But a lot of the times, and this is, more of as Hotwire Native was just getting out there over the years, it's really just like, we need an app yesterday, and they're happy to pile on the technical debt knowing that they will pay it back later. So the conversation for me has really ramped up recently with that, as I engage with these customers or these clients who already have an app and want to improve it, or I'm re-engaging with them, or they're like, hey, we need to pay back that technical debt now, you know, 2 years later or whatever. So like I said, it's like the trajectory is going up as these apps become more mature.
That makes sense. You know, there's a lot of kind of nuance probably around helping teams with, we haven't really talked too much about this yet, but the hybrid approach between thinking about like you're specifically doing a lot of things, work with Hotwire native and with Ruby on Rails applications in particular, it sounds like for the most part, which brings up you have a book called Hotwire Native for Rails Developers. But before we getting into the weeds of that, but like, can you talk a little bit about who did you write it for and what kind of developer would get the most value out of it, picking up a copy?
So the book's target audience is in the title. it's meant for Rails developers who know how to build Rails apps, have been building Rails apps for a while. They know how to do CRUD. They've messed around with Hotwire on the web, and they want a mobile app on one or both mobile platforms, but they've never done Swift or Kotlin development. They've never opened Xcode. They never opened Android Studio. This book will walk them through, okay, download Xcode from the App Store, open it, you know, install the simulator, add the Hotwire native dependency, and so on. Like, it takes you from zero to getting the phone on your physical device at the end of the book. So it takes you the whole process with zero assumptions around any native development or concepts. I consider it like mid-level Rails developer, someone who has been around the block maybe a few times, who has worked with Stimulus, because you'll use that pretty heavily, you know, is okay with doing like the generator for a command line generator to do or scaffolding type stuff, and doesn't need to be super advanced. So like, we're not going any deeper than that. And unfortunately has a Mac because you can't run Xcode without a Mac. So that cuts out a lot of people I know.
Do you think that's going to be I hadn't really thought about that particular aspect, but do you think that's something that people in Linux environments will be able to accomplish at some point, or they're always going to need to probably fire up a Mac machine to be able to do that at some point?
Yeah, it's a good question. They will be able to do the Android side. You can run Android Studio on Linux without any issues. I don't see Xcode coming off the Mac anytime soon, to be honest. And like, you can't run it on you can run it on your iPad, but like a very limited version and not something that's compatible with Hotwire native. So if you want to do iOS, you either need a Mac or like a Hackintosh, you know, or something like that.
Sure. For a long time, you know, people, we've kind of gone through these ebb and flows in the mobile space, and I've not really done much of any mobile development outside of, like, made a few code changes here and there on some client projects, but never like end to end in any capacity personally. But I'm curious about, you know, as like, for a long time, seemed like there was like, let's do hybrid because native sounds really complicated. And then it seemed like everybody needed to then kind of focus a little bit. It feels like there's these waves of, all right, let's just do this all native first and then deviate away from the hybrid. When do you think that kind of makes sense to go one path versus another when it comes to native versus hybrid?
Yeah, I will give the recommendation for a Rails app, because that's where I can say with the most confidence. If you have a Ruby on Rails app and you have a React front end, so you're doing like Rails API, you already have React on the web, build a React native iOS and Android app. Your developers are going to be most comfortable there. They're going to just keep writing JavaScript. They're not actually going to have to open Xcode too much or at all, I think, nowadays. They can just keep writing JavaScript. You already have, most importantly, you already have the APIs ready. But if you have a Hotwire web front end, if you're doing HTML over the wire, if you're just rendering boring, you know, server-side stuff, building a React native app or any sort of native app requires you to going to build every feature API again and then build it for the mobile clients, right? Like the front end for the mobile clients. So if you have that scenario, I think that hybrid Hotwire native makes so much more sense from both a getting off the ground standpoint of like, as soon as you have that V1 done, you have access to every single mobile web page on your website in the app. Because all we're doing is just rendering a little web view that's pointing to your server. And, you know, in theme with this podcast, it's the most maintainable solution. I used to work for a company where I first started with TurboLinux native at the time. And we submitted an app to the App Store. I ended up leaving the company. That app sat in the App Store untouched for almost 2 years. No native updates. But we were getting updates from the Rails server every like week or two as we added new features. So the maintenance burden was entirely on the Rails developers, the Rails team. They didn't need any mobile help because the mobile shell was done. So like, unless you're adding native features, these Hotwire native apps are extremely robust and like bulletproof and easily to main, easy to maintain because they don't require any real changes.
I saw that you had written in one of your articles about the Hotwire native mindset, I think is like a phrase you use. And so how do you think that differs or what does that look like in practice?
Hotwire native mindset is keep as much logic on the server as possible. Thin client, like thin Hotwire native client. If you have the most basic example is like you have a sign-in screen, reuse the web sign-in screen you already spent years iterating on. Don't build one natively and have to go through all the trouble of like error validation and bugs and what happens when their account is compromised and like, how do you render that natively? It's like, you've already built that. Just render the web view again. That's the biggest one. It's just like continuing to use the web for screens across the whole app. The second one is whenever you're interacting with native APIs, like you want to access the device's location or the push notification token, you're usually building out these things called bridge components. And it's a way for your JavaScript to send messages to the native app to call native code and then respond back. Making those as generic as possible is usually a really good approach to just like making sure you can keep using that across your app without having to require app updates. Classic example, if you're creating a component that adds a native button to the top of the screen, right? Don't hard code in the text of that button or the image of that button. Send that context dynamically from your HTML and have the native app dynamically pick text or image from that. That means that you can put this button on any page and it can be the same code, but on your forms, it's going to say save. And on your index page, it's going to be a plus sign. But it's still the same exact code. You're just wiring it up, your stimulus controller, with different data attributes.
Where's the bridge component? So are those things you're writing and then in Xcode or something? And then?
Yeah, you'll have like an Xcode, a Swift bridge component, an Android component, and then a stimulus controller. And they'll all interact with each other in knowing where to put it on the page, how to render it natively, what happens when the native button is tapped. But when you add it to the like the screen, so to speak, it's a stimulus controller, right? So you just add your data controller and it pops on the screen for you. So you're keeping all your configuration in your HTML is the short of it. But the implementation is spread across the three platforms.
Are there other sorts of things that people need to think about when they're, if someone were to listening and like, okay, I'm going to go experiment with this. Like what are some aspect of like, outside of having your app in the app store, what are some practical user experience benefits to having a native app or I'm not maybe like even a hybrid app, just like having the app on their phone already or their device versus logging into like the Safari or through your Chrome, just to their web interface. What is that? What sorts of value adds do you feel like people are able to accomplish with that? So I'm just thinking like help people kind of understand like, why would I even do this if it's just the web views anyways?
I find that there's three major advantages. You hit on one, discoverability through the App Store search. When there's a whole generation of people who, when you say the name of something, they don't go to Google or whatever, they're just searching the App Store for the name of that. And if you can acquire, you know, if you can get those people just because you have a presence in the app stores, that's great. Way more important for B2C than it would be for like B2B, of course, where B2Bs, it's kind of like a companion app. But if you're doing anything in the B2C space or D2C space, huge on acquisition, especially if you're targeting that market. The second one is that no matter how much developers want to fool themselves, no one adds an icon to their home screen from a website. We've been trying for years to get people to click that share button and then click add to home screen, and no one does it. PWAs exist in the context of Safari or Chrome, but very, very, very few people outside of the developer world that we live in will actually follow that flow and do anything. Which means that for most of your audience, they're never getting access to things like push notifications. And yes, you can do push notifications with PWAs, with progressive web apps. They're still just not as reliable as a native app push notification. And that brings me to the third thing. You don't have access to native APIs with a PWA. If you want to access the like built-in document scanner that exists on iOS and Android, you have to use native code, right? If you wanted the barcode scanner, you can do that for free on iOS and Android with native APIs, versus paying a third party for a JavaScript framework or what have you. And the list goes on there, you know, the access to the GPS, access to the thing that turns the device, the gyrometer or whatever, the temperature sensor, like all of those things that are native, HealthKit, Google Health, you need a native app for to access those things. And Hotwire Native gives you that bridge where you can write some JavaScript that says, hey, give me this. Your iOS, your Android code writes the native API wrapper, so to speak, and then spits it back to your JavaScript. So it's like you get the best of both worlds where you only have this thin wrapper, this thin generic wrapper around your on the clients, and the web is doing all the data manipulation. Like I wrote a component that gave the entire user's address book to the JavaScript, right? Because in the JavaScript, all they did was pluck out the email addresses to populate the HTML because they wanted to do an invite flow. So the whole invite flow was built out with Rails and HTML, except the content of the email addresses was pulled from the address book with the native side.
We'll be back with our conversation with Joe in just a moment. Hey, it's me, Robbie. Just want to say thank you. Yeah, to you. You know who you are. Thank you for listening to the pod, the podcast, or whatever you call these conversations. Hey, I was listening to this, the Maintainable Pod podcast, and I really enjoyed that conversation you had with Joe a while back. You know, one of the funny things about having a podcast is very, I mean, I get to have really good conversations with people, but it's kind of this weirdly isolating experience because I'm like talking into the ether. I'm recording this and I'm right now and it's going to send off to my editor, and then like in a month or so it's going to end up in your ears if you hear this. I'm like literally inside your head connecting brain tissue, and I'm like in your head right now. I'm in my head right now too. This is starting to sound like a Marc Maron rant. I should probably wrap this up. I just wanted to say thank you for listening to the podcast if you're listening, and you know, your reviews and ratings and Apple Podcast and Spotify or wherever you get your pods is much appreciated. But also maybe consider sharing a link to this episode in your team Slack or Teams channel or Discord or Basecamp or wherever the hell you people are working with each other these days, or on social media if you still have the patience for dealing with any of those platforms at the moment. But yeah, thanks for listening. Now, back to our conversation with Joe Mazzalotti. When you're coming into these situations with your clients and they're saying, hey, we're trying to get an app in the App Store and the Android Store, et cetera, how often is it that they've already attempted to do some work on themselves versus like completely like, hey, we have a new project and we don't know what we're doing yet, so can you at least help pave the way the first X percentage of the way there, and we'll kind of hopefully be able to ambiently learn from that process of looking at your code and we can make changes to it, versus like, okay, they've already been down the road for several months or maybe a year or so into the project?
I find that the majority of my clients fall into two camps. One is, we need an app and we don't want to do it. Can you do it for us? And that's like probably most of the clients actually I work with. That usually ends with some sort of offboarding, like to make sure they don't feel stuck if they run into a bug or a common problem. Kind of like those FAQs I talked about at the beginning, I want to provide those to the Rails developers, like in their terms. And the second half of that camp is more of, we have a mobile app, it has become unmaintainable, we cannot add new features, like we can't maintain our API, our iOS app, and our Android app, so we want to migrate to Hotwire Native. And those projects are actually the most fun because we can take 10,000 line code bases and turn them into 1,000 lines of code because we're just reusing all of the web stuff to render most of the content, if not 95%+ of the content. And it's just great to be like, yeah, I can make the entire mobile app in like 6 weeks. That's taken them 6 years to build out over time as like a fully native or like a capacitor app or React Native app or something, because it's like, you already have your mobile web views. Just use them. They're great.
Thinking about, you know, in that type of scenario where you've got a client, they've had this app for years, or when you're rewriting it to some degree or replatforming it or whatever, modernizing it, whatever language you might be using around that, are they often expecting feature parity in those scenarios, or are they able to have some like honest, like, okay, let's pull some stuff out of this, we don't need this anymore type of thing? Or what's your experience been like on that? Because I think that's always been a
challenge that I've seen a lot of companies deal with when they're thinking about switching things. Like, well, we got to keep everything the same, but upset our users.
Almost every one of the clients in that, my clients in that camp, looks for feature parity at the beginning, and then we end up cutting a handful of things. Mostly because they realize, wait a minute, we don't actually need this. Like, why do we have this? Like, let's not support it. But also sometimes with these like native integrations, it's like, we can get you 90% of the way there in 6 weeks. But that last 10% of this one feature is going to take another 6 weeks. So that's either completely cut and they just do it on the web, or it's like, okay, we'll talk to me in 6 months. We'll implement it then. Those type of approaches. Or like, I'm going to give you the tools for your developers to do it on their own. So by the end of this engagement, I can hand it over to you and you'll just build it yourself. And I can advise if you want, you know, like I can stick around for a few weeks and make sure you're not messing anything up, but I'm not going to write any code. So, but yeah, almost every time that the initial conversation is like, we need 100% feature parity with all these things. Then I go and list all the features and they're like, wait, we didn't even know about half these because they've been around for so many years.
You know, thinking about client dynamics, like, do you feel like that's something that you have a good handle on setting those expectations, or is it always end up they need to kind of work through their own realization, whether that's a rational and or emotional attachment to the way things have been versus what they'll actually, because once you start building something or you're getting further down the road of, you know, something kind of geeking out on the consulting side of things, but you could tell clients about all this stuff early on and then they're like, oh yeah, we want to keep everything. And then, but as time goes on and things get closer to needing to ship something, suddenly their tune changes a little bit. And so do you feel like that's something we can ever actually crack? Or is it something that's just part of the adventure? And we're like, here we go.
I do like calling it an adventure. That's a good word there. I think that one thing that I do to try to mitigate that kind of problem or that adventure is that I do scope-based projects. So I can come to them and say, hey, this is going to take 6 weeks if we cut these two features. And if we don't want to cut those two features, it's going to like double the cost. And here are two estimates of those approaches. And they can tell me right there, like with their wallet, this is how important these features are. And I find sometimes, like when I used to do hourly work, we would always just like get to the last 2 weeks and then try to cram all this stuff in because they had a budget that they didn't tell me and they're just like paying me hourly to hope they can get as much done as possible. And all of those issues have pretty much been removed since I moved to project-based fees because they can see the cost and the deliverables up front. And yeah, you know, complications arise and sometimes we have to change those things and everyone's flexible, but like having the stake in the ground of knowing that this is going to be a X cost project versus a 4X project is a really good way of asking someone, how important is this last 5% right now?
It sounds like that you must have a lot of confidence to some degree in your ability to estimate.
or I just stress out the last 2 weeks of our project. I think that I've been doing this in some way, shape, or form for 6 years, like just the consulting side. And of all of the clients that I work with, like 60 to 75% of a project is exactly the same. It's the exact same stuff. It's, you know, web-based, it's authentication, it's push notifications, it's getting in the app stores, and it's a couple bridge components. It's that last 15 to 35%, which is really what I'm actually only estimating. And it makes the estimation, it's a smaller portion of the total project. So it's like, there's way less risk on it. You know, if I totally underestimate that last 35%, it's still only 35%, right? Which gives me a lot of leeway to make mistakes there. So I can go in and give estimates very confidently, knowing that even if I'm like really wrong, I'll still be probably okay.
You know, that's interesting. You're thinking around how you're working on probably very different projects, but very similar implementation type of things you're navigating. So that makes sense. And I think, and I live in a world where like, we want to add these, we think we have this new feature ideas we want to add onto the app, the web app, and or some new API thing. And we got to integrate with some third party that no one's ever heard of, but they got a really good contract deal with on that. And they're going to save so much money on that side of it. Very different sort of environment. And so I was kind of curious how you thought about that, because it's always been the struggle of project versus time-based billing and whether you're, however you're, you know, sizing that up or whatever. It still sounds like you're using like a 6-week cycle or to kind of help you kind of think about what that might entail, how much you can accomplish in a period of time. And you're also, do you work with other developers yourself, or are you a solo freelancer contractor type of scenario?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I work so entirely by myself, and maybe I'll work with the developers on the team. Maybe not. Maybe I'm just throwing code over the fence and they're saying yes or no. So I can really estimate, like, I'm taking a couple weeks off in May to take some time for myself. I made sure that the clients that I have know that, and that work's going to slow down during that time to a standstill because no one else is working on it. But to like your work there is totally different from mine. Like, I am the closest I get to estimating something I've never done before is me spending like a week reading through the documentation of like almost building it entirely on my own before I say, okay, it's going to take me this long. Like, if I have to do Microsoft authentication for a client right now, I spent about a week digging into the docs, trying to build a proof of concept, like making sure that I caught the big issues before I actually sent a proposal to them. I caught like the rough, not all the rough edges, but like, okay, this is a 6-week engagement and not a 6-month engagement. You know, like that's the type of scale I'm looking for when I talk about these things, or like how many 6-week chunks is it going to take?
That makes sense. It's interesting because you're also kind of doing discovery on behalf of a potential client. And so do you have a lot of confidence that you're going to get that project, or like just thinking about that dynamic? Anyone listening of like, you know, part of me is like, are you doing free work, or are you just figuring out how to bake that into your project later?
Yeah, a little bit of both. What I do, my process is I have a discovery call where we just chat about what they need. And I try to get an estimate on their budget, you know, like a very rough estimate, just to see like what type of client are they wanted? Do they want to spend $5,000, $50,000, $150,000? Like where are they on that scale, their timeline and their scope? And then based on that, I come back to them at a very rough estimate on price. So like a 50% difference in price. Like my last client, I think I said, it's going to be like $25,000 to $45,000 for this project, which is a very big range, but it gives them the opportunity to say like, that is totally out of the ballpark, or like, yeah, cool, let's do it. Then I go back and I know that I've pretty much landed them. And then I do the, okay, let's really find out how much integration this is going to be. So I've given them a ballpark estimate. And, you know, sometimes I come back and I'm like, oh crap, like I actually should have charged way more for this. But then I know for next time. And even if they still say no at the end, I'll have learned how to do it for a future client, and I'll document that and know, like, I have all my, not my spreadsheets, but like I charge this client this much because their budget was that, and like they added this feature. So it gets easier and easier as I just cover more ground.
It sounds like what we've referred to as a swag, a scientific wild ass guess, but usually referring back to some other spreadsheets of like, okay, how much did we charge that client for those that work? And how much time did we log on that? And then we try to, I can appreciate that. I'm also thinking around, you come in these situations where you're talking with clients about, so if it's like, let's just imagine there's some Rails development team, some people that work at a company that works with Rails, and they're like, oh, we've been kind of curious about this. Maybe we're going to pick up the book and maybe teach ourselves, or maybe we should hire someone like Joe to come in and help do that first initial version of it. But do you find that they often know what their budget is to build something, or is it something they intend to have to react to something that you throw out there because they're just like, we don't really know how long this might take yet?
I find that the closer a company is to their set scope, the more they are like, we need these 5 features and we'll not settle for anything less, the more they have an understanding of what their budget is. When the more, and then the more nebulous the request, the less they have confidence in having a budget, or at least the less that they will let me be privy to. So a lot of times with the more educational engagements where I'm like doing workshops or advising, or like, let me just pull request review type stuff, they will be like, I don't know, $5,000 to $80,000. And I'm like, well, you know, what do you want to spend? I try to do very little negotiating with clients. If they tell me what they want to spend, I will build an engagement that works for that price. And I have a lot of levers that I can pull. You know, if they want to pay less money, I can push more work on them. If they want to pay more money, I can put more work on myself. And the offboarding is maybe it's 1 hour of just a call like this, or it's 5 hours of recorded video that's edited by me. Like, I have all these levers to pull for them to get exactly what they want based on their price. So it's very little like, well, what if we cut this? And then how much is it that cost? And it's like, I don't want to do that. I want you to tell me how much you want to spend, and I'm going to give you what you need.
I like that. Do you, you know, sticking our little around back to the topic of, say, maintainability and, you know, like this approach, maybe a hybrid approach, does have a more, maybe more maintainable approach when it comes to longevity of where you're working and what code bases and types of people that potentially work on the projects. If you're kind of coming into these scenarios and helping build up a new app and you help them push it out to the app stores and such, and then you're kind of like do the offboarding and hand them the keys, be like, call me if you need help at one point. Do you get a sense that teams know where to, enough for them to feel like they can continue maintaining in the long run? Or are they hoping they don't actually have to touch it that much? And kind of curious about that part of it.
I think that the teams that have a very clear V2, so to speak, hit the ground running. They're like, great, we know exactly what we want to build next and we want to do it in-house. So please offboard us in these three areas. And they, like, the week after the project, the engagement ends, while I still have access to GitHub because they haven't gotten around to removing me, like, I'll see commits from them. You know, like, they're adding new features, they're working on things. The clients that are way more, or that are more like, yeah, build it for us and then, you know, we'll take over, they don't touch the repo for 6 months. And they're totally happy because they don't have to touch the iOS code or the Android code. Like, that's exactly what they wanted. I feel like I have around a 2-year cycle with clients. I'll work with someone for 3 to 9 months, I'd say. And then like 2 years later, they'll reach back out and be like, hey, we want to do a new version and we're getting stuck on these things. Or we haven't touched the code in 2 years. Like, please come save us. But it's more of, we have a V2 out there and we want to do a V3 and, you know, we need some help figuring out the right way to do things. Can you come advise for us?
What would be your recommendation to those teams that don't need to touch it very often? Do you think that's wise to let it sit there for a long period? I mean, it's kind of great that you don't have to do anything, but if it becomes this like out of sight, out of mind thing, and not that don't want to be reliant on being able to come back to you for repeat business necessarily, but for the benefit and the risk management on their end, and like that gap between the last time someone touched it. Because we've seen so many projects where like nobody's touched that thing and nobody wants to break it, is the underlying theme there, less than like, oh, we don't need to. It's more like, I don't want to break it.
I think that Hotwire Native is this weird scenario where you don't need to touch it. There's nothing they could be doing to change it besides opening it in Xcode and like building it, you know? And I think that, I always recommend when I disengage, like, hey, a new version of Xcode gets released, a new version of Android Studio, download it, build the app and see if you have any warnings or errors. Like, start there. And that's a really good excuse to be familiar with the code base and just like essentially click the update for latest version button and make sure that it still works. But why I don't worry is that it's not like they're not just looking at the code. They're still using the app every day. Like they're aware of if there are any bugs or issues that are being introduced or falling through the cracks. So I feel pretty confident that like the product is still working. A lot of times they just like, they don't want to touch the code base, and that's fine by me. like I'm happy to come in there and look at it for 3 weeks every 2 years. I feel like, you know, everyone's happy there. They're getting a mobile app for an order of magnitude, if not multiple orders of magnitude, cheaper than like hiring native developers. And they just have a little bit of reliance on an external party. Like if they're ahead of the game and they hire me with enough notice, nothing's ever broken.
Do you find that, you know, comparing like a web application versus like, say, a mobile app, how these clients that you're working with or companies that you talk to, that I'm always trying to encourage people to not rewrite. So in a way, it's like, do you feel like this web apps versus, say, a mobile app, one of them seems more dispensable in some way? Like, it's like, we can toss this out and kind of restart it again one day.
I think that hybrid apps are a lot lighter than their fully native counterparts and their web counterparts. And honestly, by design, a couple hundred lines of code is maybe 1,000 lines of code, maybe 2,000 lines of code is really all these native apps require to be fully functioning versus the how many millions of lines of code of like a real big Rails app, right? Like that's a huge number, many orders of magnitude of difference. And I think that that's okay because you're still relying on the Rails app for everything. You're still relying on the server for everything. And one of the really nice things about the Hotwire Native approach is if you want to take a screen and upgrade it to a fully native experience, you can pick and choose those individual screens to make them native. Like if you have a really core piece of functionality of your app that would be way better served with fancy animations and like, you know, full GPU acceleration from the device, you can drop down to native code just for that one screen and then go right back to the web for every other screen. And that only requires a small switch statement to then hop into native land. So you're actually in this really nice sweet spot of feature parity with the web, quote, for free. And then you can go in like version one. Oh, we added this native screen. Version 1.1, we added this native screen. And you're given the freedom to just like upgrade at will without having to go all in on a fully native app. Like if you look at the Basecamp or the Hey app, every one of those home screens, the screen you launch to is fully native. But as soon as you tap on any button or any link, you're in web world. And to the user, you might not ever notice that. But if you launch that app, it loads instantly because it's a native screen and it's got cache data that's written to the disk, right? And that's a really great example of like, oh, version 2, we're going to make our app launch 10 times faster. You don't have to abandon Hotwire native for that. You can just build that for that one screen.
Hey folks, it's Robbie here. I want to share a quick story. We just had a big kickoff call with one of our newer clients, and afterward, I got a message on LinkedIn from one of the engineers on their team. And he said, hey, I've been listening to the podcast and subscribed to one of your newsletters for quite a while. And I was actually the one who mentioned Planet Argon to our stakeholders like 6 months ago. And now we're working together. In the world of running a software consultancy like ours, that kind of thing means the world to our team. So if you're a developer at a company that's got big goals this year, but not quite ready to make the commitment to full-time hires, we'd love to help. We offer staff augmentation, fractional development services for teams that need to move fast without locking in long-term. We work with Ruby on Rails, React, Laravel, and more, just to name a few. If this sounds like something your manager should know about, send them our way. PlanetArgon.com. That's PlanetArgon.com. All right, let's get back to the show. So I want to take a couple of last questions for you. First, I want to get some advice from you for our audience. So let's just imagine some people out there listening, and maybe they work with some different tech stacks than Ruby and Rails, but they've been doing some backend web application development for a while. They've maybe worked with iOS teams and they've integrated. If they're kind of curious to learn more about this outside of picking up your book, what sort of experiments would you encourage them to do? Or do you get a sense, like, I feel like some developers feel very intimidated about this other land of like going into like, oh, if I have to open up Xcode, I'm going to feel lost as a Ruby developer. And so do you feel like it's some advice on how to like get over that little mental hurdle? I mean, like maybe I could do a little bit of this.
Yeah, I think that now, today's day and age, so to speak, is a really good time to experiment with languages that you aren't familiar with the help of LLMs. You ask an LLM like, hey, build me a Hotwire native app. And it's going to be like, no, sorry, not enough information online. But if you say, hey, build me an iOS app or an Android app, there is so much on the web that they'll be able to pull from that you can get a good understanding of it. And a follow-up question to that is like, okay, now walk through this line by line and relate it to, you know, insert package or framework that I already understand. You can now have a translation of those apps to Laravel or Elixir or, you know, what Rails, like whatever you're used to working with. And I think that even if you don't ever open Xcode or Android Studio, like having the understanding of like the complexities that go into those apps will make you make better decisions on going hybrid might make a lot more sense. Or actually doing this natively is really just one more API because we only need to do one screen, you know, and we can mostly LLM this thing. Like, and I think that now's a really good time to just like, you have that native developer expert available to you at all times. And you can get by pretty scrappy version based on your like existing programming experience with that little bit of help or a lot of bit of help from, you know, ChatGPT or what have you.
Are there specific tools right now that you're finding to be quite helpful? I haven't really talked to too many people. We talk about AI and how it can be used to help you maintain your software, but and try not to be too timely with this conversation necessarily. And like in the sense of like, we're recording this in late April, 2025. So take that for a grain of salt. Like things could be wildly different in like a month by now. But what are you finding to be kind of to be helpful for one, doing these types of experiments, but then two, maintaining the projects you're working on?
I only really use ChatGPT's web interface. I find that I don't want context on my entire app. I want like, hey, this is the class or the couple files that I'm interested in. Let me just copy paste them in here and ask some questions about it. And like now the AI has all the context it needs, the context I think it needs, I should say. But I found that that just keeps the scope small enough where things aren't changed across modules that I had no intention of looking at. And maybe I'm missing out on some great refactoring opportunities, but like that's not what I'm asking for. I'm saying, here's the code that's raising the issue. Here's the stack trace. Like, what is going on here? Like, those are the mostly the questions that I'm asking. Or like, hey, here's some iOS code. How would you do it in Android? And those type of conversations are super interesting because it's like, oh my God, I didn't even know this syntax existed in Kotlin because I've never like officially learned Kotlin from a book or anything. And oh, on Android, there's this view models thing, but it's actually like capital V, capital M view models, you know, like it's a first party thing, but on iOS, it's called something else entirely. And like creating those synapses in your brain with insert your framework of choice versus the new language you're learning, I think accelerates it so much because the goal for me is like to stop asking the LLM eventually, because I already have it all in my head. But right now, as I'm still kind of learning it more, and as you know, the dear listener might be by learning it more, relating it to what you know is like a superpower because it just makes it click so easily.
I was having a conversation coincidentally earlier today because we do primarily Ruby on Rails stuff, but we do have some Laravel projects. We have a couple people that are more experienced with Laravel, and I heard that we were bringing on another Laravel developer soon, and I was like, oh, can't there some of our Rails developers pick up on that a little bit quicker these days now that we've got LLMs to help? And there's kind of like a yes and no, like they don't feel like they're going to be experts at that immediately type of thing. And I'm like, well, they can figure it out, I think. So thanks for sharing some advice on that for our listeners. Couple of quick last questions. One, is there a non-technical, non-software book that you find yourself recommending to peers?
If you'd asked me this like 2 weeks ago, it would have been a different book. So good timing here. There's a book called Please Unsubscribe, Thanks. And it's extremely depressing. So don't start off thinking it's going to be some like feel good book. It's essentially about how we as an American culture have become so subscription fatigued and blind. And it talks a lot about like subscriptions to, you know, big media and big tech, blah, blah, blah. But the stuff that I took away from it is there's an exercise to write down, go through your bank account for your last 12 months and write down every single recurring subscription you have. First, make a guess on how many you have. I guessed I had 20. I had 45 monthly subscriptions. And my wife had another 28 or something between the two of us. And a lot of them are obvious, you know, Netflix, Disney Plus, Heroku. And then I was like, I have a subscription for a toothbrush? What? Like a quarterly toothbrush subscription? I didn't even know I had it because it was getting sent to my address in New York. I haven't lived there in 5 years. Like things like that were just mind-blowing. And it walks you through a lot of exercises like this where you've become so numb and so just fatigued by these that you don't even see them anymore at all. And it is extremely eye-opening. And we've been making a lot of changes to our lives based on this book. And that subscription one really, really hit home because it was like, whew, that's a lot.
I'm gonna pick up a copy of that for myself. Include links to that in the show notes for our listeners as well. I know I was just looking over. I have like some reminders every quarter. It'll like remind me to open up like it was like a hot link or a hyperlink to my App Store subscriptions page or something. And I'm like, it forces me to go in there and be like, what's all in here? What do I need to like? Am I using that? And I'm like, apps in particular. And I'm like, oh, I did that free trial and I completely forgot. And I'm like, it became like a $90 a year thing. And I'm like, oh, right. And then I'm like, well, now I should start using it, right? I'm like, that's probably the wrong thing to be.
That's the power of subscriptions. It's easy to not change them. It's easy to just let them continue to be deducted from your bank account and you not notice. And then you feel obligated to use them, even though you probably forgot about it.
And then when you try to unsubscribe, they'll like offer you a discount.
This is a good one. I unsubscribed from Hulu or something, and their promotional offer at the end was not, would you like do you want to pause it or whatever? Would you like to upgrade to ad free for $5 more a month? And it was like,
wow,
read the room. Like, I'm canceling here. Don't offer me an upgrade.
Oh, I love that. Well, thanks for that, Joe. Where can listeners best follow your thoughts and ruminations about software engineering online?
I post everything mostly to my website, which is mazzalotti.com. I'm sure there'll be a link in the show notes. That's got links to my newsletter, my book, and the social media accounts that I'm posting to. But mostly the newsletter these days. It's been fun to have some real communication through that instead of, you know, in public.
Well, I would definitely include links, as you said, in the show notes for everybody. And with that, it's been such a delight having you join us on Maintainable, Joe. Thank you so much for stopping by to talk shop with us.
Yeah, this was fun. I'm glad we got to dive into some consulting stuff.
You've been listening to Maintainable, a Planet Argon production. Editing by Claudia Armbruster. Post-production by Autumn Morgan and Ella Svensson. Emotional support from the letter M. For Maintainable, for momentum, for making things better. If this episode resonated with you, share it with someone who needs to hear it. Keep showing up. See you next time. Maintainable.